This is Candace Ellis and Pete Foster on July 7th, 2011 in Orlando at the Panama Canal reunion, talking about living in the Panama Canal Zone. So usually where I like to start is right at the beginning, how you came to be in the zone or how your family came to be in the zone.
And you're ready for me to say?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, well, basically, I'd have to go back to my parents first to get to the zone. And my mom and dad were, they were born in the Cayman Islands, and they were British subjects. And my dad was a sea captain that had licenses for both the square riggers and the steam. And to give you a little information on the island that I'm talking, the Cayman Islands, there's three islands. In the middle island, there's a large island, a middle island, and a small island. Mm-hmm. And the middle island was discovered mainly by shipwrecked ships. And the middle island was in the initial stages of its discovery and all, divided up by into five sections that were whatever sea captain discovered or planted and stayed there. Mm-hmm. They laid out their portion of land on there. My great grandfather was a sea captain whose ship hit the island and had a shipwreck. So his portion of the island was called the Bluff, which was a 100-foot high bluff that went almost the whole length of the island. And in old maps, you'll see that area marked Foster Land. And from there, my dad became a sea captain also. And but during that time, in the middle time, my mom's parents were killed or were washed away in the tidal wave that hit the island, and my mom survived, and her uncle and aunt, who lived in Mobile, Alabama at that time, brought her over to Mobile, and she was raised in Mobile. And my dad's primary port, he became a sea captain of a cargo ship that plied between the United States and South America. And the group of Caymanians that were in Mobile was where my mom and dad met each other. They did not know each other on the island, but they met in Mobile, Alabama. And they both became naturalized U.S. citizens. So my dad, of course, was going his ship. He was taking his ship between the United States and South America. And in those days, too, for cargo ships, the sea captain took his family with him, if he wanted to. So, and my oldest brother was born in Mobile. And they were, my dad had a voyage to take cargo down to Ecuador. And as when they were going through the canal, he stopped at the canal because he had to go down the Atlantic and then go across over to the Pacific to get to Ecuador. So at the canal zone, getting ready to go through the locks, he stopped had to stop in Cristobal, which is on the port on the Atlantic side of to refuel. In refueling, and I guess it was a slow process in those days. We're going back to 1929, and the crash came. The crash came in the States, and the company owned the ship that my dad was captain on could not be moved because a lawsuit litigation started. And so he had to stay with the ship, and it couldn't be moved simply because of the litigation and all that sort of stuff. So after 3 years, well, in 29 at the same time, I was born in 1929, and my mom then, they got an apartment in Colon, which is the Panamanian Atlantic city, mm-hmm. and it's the second largest city in Panama. And being born in Colon, of course, in those days, I had to be registered in the U.S. Embassy and all that sort of stuff they wanted to make sure that later on in years I would be recognized as a U.S. citizen. Mm-hmm. After that, after living in Colon for about 3 years, in about 1935, the litigation was over. My dad could leave the ship alone, and so he had to get a job. And he got a job on the Gatun Locks. And at that time, of course, the canal furnished homes for their employees. Mm-hmm. And the Panama Canal Commission, they didn't know. I'm getting into a little discrimination problem that they did. When they built the canal, a major portion of their working employees were West Indian, mm-hmm. So when they hired my dad, they didn't know at that time whether to put him on as a U.S. citizen or something different, a non-U.S. citizen, I'll put it that way.
Uh-huh.
Now, they were used to mostly colored people working, and they call those the non-U.S. citizens. And at that time, they had established a payment way of designating whether you were a United States citizen or whether you were a non-United States citizen. They called the United States citizens the gold drove, mm-hmm. and they were paid in gold and U.S. dollars. The non-U.S. citizens were on the silver roll, and they were paid the local salary.
Right.
So since there was some kind of discussion on it there, they let us live in the gold section, the U.S. section, but only by near the railroad tracks.
Oh my goodness. So there was some discrimination there, definitely?
Mm-hmm. Actually, yes. We had a French couple that also was hired by the canal, and they lived on the non-U.S. side of the railroad tracks, so we lived on the U.S. side, but only we had to stay close to the edge of the town.
So the discrimination was based more on citizenship than, you know, because if you were a white European, you'd still be put on that silver standard because you were not.
Yeah,
okay,
right,
that's
right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that, of course, his pay scale was lower than his other U.S. friends and all. And I went to U.S. schools there in Gatun and all. And surprising thing about it is that even during Christmas time, the people in the town in Gatun would give us bags of food, you know. So they, mm-hmm. I guess they felt sorry for us. But anyway.
Was it difficult growing up for that reason? Was there discrimination against you, or were you guys, did you guys ever struggle financially?
Well, I guess my parents had struggled a little financially. My dad also bought a boat, and he on his non-work days, he would take the boat, and he had two helpers on the boat that they would go up some of the islands and fill their barge with sand and come mm-hmm. back for them to have sand to build houses with the cement and mm-hmm. all. And so he made up the difference in pay through his own little mm-hmm. business too. But they treated me, there was no difference.
Mm-hmm.
Parents, now you're talking about some old Southern people. We had a little bit of a difference there. There were two sides. One, I guess the ones from the north and all treated us, there was no difference. The south the southerners were a little.
Really? So there was detectable tension with that.
Right.
Does anything stand out in particular, anyone experience, or just the way they treated you?
Oh, just the way they treated me. We had the commissaries, that's what their produce stores was, and it was everything was run by the U.S. government, by the Panama Canal
mm-hmm.
Company, everything.
Yeah.
And so in Gatun, where we lived, their commissary was divided into two portions. It was a two-story building, and the second floor was. And of course, it was the gold roll, they called it, the gold side. And the first floor was the silver roll. And the people they did not use cash in purchasing. What you did was at the beginning of each month, you told them how much. You wanted issued what they call commissary books.
Mm-hmm.
And they were had strips of one penny each in it, and you'd buy a $15 commissary book or a $5 one, or it went like that. And when you went through the line to pay the cashier, they would tear off the amount of strips, and some of them were, some of the cashiers were outstanding. I mean, they'd take that thing would fall down, and they'd tear it off, and you'd wonder, how did they
count that?
Yeah, but they did. So we had, because of the confusion of some people not wanting to recognize, I guess in the headquarters didn't want to recognize us as an equal U.S. citizen,
mm-hmm.
they decided then, so that just to protect themselves, I guess, my mom and dad could buy either gold or silver commissary books. So what they would do is, of course, on the silver roll, it was a they had some foods and all a lot cheaper in the first floor than it was on the second floor. The meats were different types of meat and all. It's like you in a butcher shop, you might, in their really upscale butcher shop, you wouldn't find tripe.
Right.
But in the silver roll commissary, they had the lower cost meats and all, and tripe was one of them, and things like that. And so, of course, my mom would buy whatever she thought was better and cheaper in either commissary. Mm-hmm. I mean, but for me, the way I got along, it was being by the railroad track. And later on in our time in Gatun, we moved. They had down at the very bottom of the road and hill, they had what they called the corral, and that was the motor transportation today. Mm-hmm. But in those days, they still used horse-drawn buggies and all to transfer the work and load and all that sort of stuff. And at the bottom, then they had one cottage. Why they built the cottage, don't ask. But it was one cottage, and then the colored town, which was a silver town. I mean, but in those days, we called them colored town. They were nice. They were okay. And that, for me, it was, I guess, being a kid and all, I guess, fun. But in order to have money, since my mom and dad didn't give me an allowance and all, I would go into the bush in there, and during the construction of the canal, the workers' families and all would wherever they were, they'd build themselves a house and they would have all a garden. In the garden, some of them grew pineapple and various limes, various things. So they would, I decided that it would, I might be able to get by selling these high class Americans some groceries that they couldn't get or couldn't keep. So I'd go out into the bush and hunt for a lime tree patch. And then I would make a bag, about a dozen limes per bag, and sell it for 10 cents each, go to the commissary. And they would purchase these limes from me. They had another plant called kapok. I don't know if you, kapok, it was the cotton used in those days. Mm-hmm. It was similar, very similar to cotton balls, but it grew on a tree rather than the way true cotton is. And when they were blooming, I would get those, and the women in the town would use the kapok for filling the cushions and all in their house. Mm-hmm. And also the kapok was used for life preservers, the floating life preservers. Okay, so.
You sound like a very enterprising young businessman.
Yeah, and then the pineapples were another thing that I would get. But the main thing about that was, for me, was that the colored people would tell me, "Pete, up over there and that little, there's a patch over there ready for you to pick." And then, "Pete, kapok is out now." And they would.
And about how old were you?
I was doing that through from the I think it was the third grade until the sixth grade, and I did that. Actually, the other thing that I do is as I got older, and I guess I started about when I was 7 years old, I took boxing lessons, and then they would have children's boxing on Monday nights in the clubhouse. Mm-hmm. And if you won, you got two tickets to the movies.
Good deal.
So I made it a point that every Monday I would box for my two tickets to go to the movies. Mm-hmm. And of course I made sure that I won. Mm-hmm. I was very good at it. And then I decided that, hey, if I called bingo for them in those days, they had bingo every, bingo was on, it doesn't matter, Monday nights, not Monday nights, either Friday nights, I guess it was, and I'd call bingo. Of course, you didn't have the amplifiers and the mics and all that sort of stuff, and I'd get a dollar to call bingo, and it was about a two-hour job. Mm-hmm. And then after bingo, we would at the clubhouse, of course that's where we purchased food and all, and they had a soda counter and ice cream there, and but I could get and then on top of that, the way they handled it is that they would have a ticket $5, $10, $15, $20, up to a dollar. And the waiter then would punch the amount of money that you had to pay, mm-hmm. and then you'd take that out to the cashier and pay. And so I would get a Klim shake. Now, a Klim shake is, I don't know whether you know what Klim was.
Mm-mm.
Klim is milk backwards.
Okay.
Okay, and that's a powdered, it was a powdered milk.
Mm-hmm.
And they, in those days, they didn't have the liquid milk, fresh milk for cereals and all. They used Klim. And in fact, I found it. They still sell it in countries in Central America.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd get a Klim shake, hot roast beef sandwich, and French fries for 25 cents.
Wow.
Now, it might have cost more, but my waiters were all on the silver roll. They were colored,
mm-hmm.
and they lived across the border. Some of them lived close by me,
mm-hmm.
and I never paid more than 25 cents for anything I ate, because they would always have some tickets to give me for 25 cents. Mm-hmm. And they would only punch 25 cents in my ticket. So that was nice. That was a good way.
Yeah, you've kind of illuminated this interesting race dynamic in the area. And we found, you know, some people may not have been aware of any kind of tension or didn't perceive it as even existing there,
yeah.
but you've kind of, you know, told a different story, I guess. And, you know, just this business with the railroad tracks and stuff, like what your family went through. So in a broader sense, what would you say growing up the state of the race relations were, and was there the heavy, you know, tension that there were with the Southerners who were in the zone? Was there any violence or issues, or was it?
No, it
yeah.
was, they accepted it the way it was, but mm-hmm. they would, I had friends that maybe the father was a U.S. citizen that mm-hmm. married a Panamanian girl.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and if they had some of my friends that I went to school with, that I grew up with, were Panamanians. Not Panamanian, they were U.S. citizens because they were born, their parents were U.S. citizens. Mm-hmm. But the only one side of the family had to be a U.S. citizen to begin with. Mm-hmm. So the mother, let's say the mother is a Panamanian and the father is a U.S. and the son, the child is born in between the two of them and they grow up together. The hidden discrimination is that a good example that I would have is that when you put in to move to a house within the canal zone, you were assigned the house according to your job. Of course, if you're on the gold roll, you had the authority to live in the U.S. towns, basically. And but in that same, under that same cat, if the father is on the gold roll and but married to a Panamanian and the children are U.S. citizens and they would go to school with me and all that sort of stuff. When it came to assigning houses, it was on a typically a service portion, a service assignment. If you were had 1 year worked at the canal, 1 year more than another person putting in for the same house, the one with the most service would get the house. Mm-hmm. But it didn't hold when the family with the U.S. and Panamanian would give the assignment to the
less experienced.
That's both U.S. Mm-hmm. both parents are U.S. citizens.
What was the quality of the housing like throughout the zone?
Well, the houses when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. They still had the old, what we call the old French quarters that were for family, still there. Mm-hmm. In Balboa, it was there. And in Gatun, Gatun was a newer part of the town. But and then when they started to build the third set of blocks, mm-hmm. right during and after World War II, they considered those employees working on a special engineering project, mm-hmm. SIPers is what we call them.
SIP.
Mm-hmm. And they had to build those towns real fast, and so they built 12 families in one building, and of course the houses were not double walled between apartments. Mm-hmm. If you flushed the toilet in your bathroom, the neighbor next to you can hear, and they're back to back. And it would be a straight through where you'd have the kitchen and bathroom, bedroom, a little living room, and a porch. Mm-hmm. And all of them were screened in, and they were all wood. And of course, they were on stilts. All the houses were, in those days, were on stilts. And then they'd have protection of metal protection around the top of the post or the stilts, mm-hmm. with painted with some kind of creosote actually to stop creatures from going into your house.
Mm-hmm. Did you remain in the same house most of the time you were there, or did you move around?
No, I lived in every town except Pedro Miguel. I lived in Ancon. We had a house in Ancon. I lived in Balboa. I lived at La Boca, Gamboa, Gatun's where we started from. And they had, well, they had Old Cristobal. Old Cristobal was where the ports were and all. And then they had New Cristobal. New Cristobal was a complete Panhandle town under the jurisdiction of the Panamanians. So our police were Panamanians. But even the primary hotel for the Atlantic side built by the canal was in that area. And of course they had the most beautiful saltwater pool that I grew up with. And then right next to it was Fort de Lesseps, which they had 16-inch cannons that were to protect the breakwater from any attack. And the houses in New Cristobal were older, but they had cottages and duplexes and up and downs. Up and down was a duplex with two floors, and they also had four families and two families. Some two families were the whole bottom, almost built similar to a four family, and then another family up above.
What high school did you go to?
I went to both.
Both of them.
I went to Cristobal High School, and in my sophomore year, my parents were transferred to Gamboa, and they finally they recognized my parents as equal U.S. citizens shortly after the war, simply because when they started to have their military coming back, some of them were naturalized U.S. citizens, and they couldn't discriminate against their own military coming back. And so right after the war, they were instructed to recognize all naturalized U.S. citizens as equal. And so they immediately had to recognize my dad's captain's license, and he was put on a tugboat as captain of a tugboat there, and so that let's see, where were we going here now?
What year did you graduate high school?
47 Cristobal High School. Sophomore year, they went to Gamboa, and to get to Balboa High School, you'd have to take a train. They had no good road, and so the kids in Gamboa would take a train to Balboa High School, and the towns, the elementary schools, each town had their own elementary school. High school was Balboa or Cristobal, I started out in Cristobal High School. My parents were transferred to Gamboa, and in my sophomore year, I went to Balboa High School. But I had a little difference of opinion with the principal. He had a difference of opinion of me. But there was one teacher that first week that I went over there, Spanish teacher, and I made the mistake of correcting her Spanish, and she sent me down to the office, to the principal, and that was the first week. And of course I got a lecture from the principal, and then they sent me back to the room. And then the next day I was still unfamiliar with high school, and I was about, I would say about 20 seconds or 30 seconds late for class. She sent me down to the principal, And it became a game with me. I figured, okay, well, the next day I'd get there right on time. But the day before, then the next one, then I would, slow down. All of a sudden, I'm a minute late. I'd stand outside the door and wait until the bell rang, look at my watch, and step in. And finally, about halfway through the year, and of course, I got along fine with all the other teachers, the principal lost his temper. And when he lost his temper, I threw an inkwell at him.
Inkwell.
In those days, yeah. Your pens were, you dipped it in ink. Mm-hmm.
At the principal?
Yep, and it left him with a little mark.
Oh my goodness. So were you kicked out of the school? Or?
No, he didn't suspend me because he was the one that caused the problem. Mm-hmm. And, he said, Pete, how in the heck can I get rid of you? And I said, well, Ellister, something like that was his name. Esser was his name. Mm-hmm. Said, all you have to do is that in Gamboa was the middle of the zone here, mm-hmm. area. So the train going, the Panama Railroad train going to Balboa would meet with the train going to Cristobal. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, look it, I want to go to Cristobal. You want me to go to Cristobal. Mm-hmm. Just talk them into giving me a pass, because we have school passes for the train.
Right.
Give me a pass instead to go into Balboa. Give me a pass to go to Cristobal. And I said, you won't see me in this building for years. And he said, is that all you need? I said, that's all I need. So he said, okay, I'm not going to see you next year because you're going to go Cristobal. And that's what I did for it. But I had to take the train every morning to Cristobal and then walk through Colon, walk through the town, mm-hmm. to Cristobal High School. And when I left Cristobal, I left it in under good terms with all the teachers. And so they made sure, the principal, it was Hoax at that time, made sure that all my classes were, the first class was a study hall. Mm-hmm. And then, so that would give me time to get to the school. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, and I was voted as class president in both junior year and senior year. And I did all right, and I graduated half year. I had so many credits. That was my Balboa. But it was nice because then we, living in Gamboa, I could bring my Cristobal friends, when they had a party or anything like that, I could bring my Cristobal friends over, and they knew me, and they would bring their Balboa friends. And so what it did was it gave them a group of students, mm-hmm. that intermingled, and we knew each other. And so when the games were going and all, mm-hmm. afterwards, it was just a big friendly.
No harsh feelings.
No harsh feelings, mm-hmm. or anything like that.
Did you play any sports?
I started to, but when I got too involved in the with being class president and all, and then when I was going by the train, I couldn't stay after school to.
Yeah.
When I was a freshman and then in the junior, when I became a junior, the 11th year, I didn't like baseball, but I was in track. I did their track for a while, we got too involved, not only with
student government,
the student government, but I also got involved with my wife.
Oh, is that when you guys met in high school?
Yep, we went together from junior year to last year. She passed away.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
Had 63 years of marriage and...
That's amazing.
And 2 years in high school. We were teenagers that matured together into adulthood. Mm-hmm. And so we...
That's really incredible.
And then you go to the of course, I graduated in January rather than in June because of my credits.
You graduated early, because you had all the credits.
Yeah.
What was it like, going to high school during World War II when that was happening overseas? What was the zone like?
The zone, at that time, when Pearl Harbor was hit, mm-hmm. and then they went on the 11th. They went to Germany. Germany. They declared war on Germany on the 11th of December, and actually, my wife left the United States. They packed. In 1941, they packed. Her father got a job in the canal, and so they packed up on December 7th and left. They were headed for the Panama Canal on the Panama Canal ships. They had three ships, mm-hmm. and left on the Panama Canal ships on December 11th and arrived 5 days later in the zone. Mm-hmm. But they were all in their black. And on December 7th, mm-hmm. not only is it Pearl Harbor Day, but that's the day my wife passed away. Mm-hmm. So, but she's from Ohio. Okay. And but anyway, getting back to that, as soon as the canal had a feeling that, to me, they had a feeling that we were going to go to war. And when Pearl Harbor was hit, there was a rumor, and it was probably true, that the Japanese had subs headed for the canal. Mm-hmm. And what we started to do, of course, right immediately, we had blackouts at night.
Right.
All the cars' lights were, they would have a one-inch strip of masking tape mm-hmm. on the light, headlights, and paint the rest black, and then it'd take off. So all you had that was that little strip.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then the towns had smoke pots placed in various locations. Now these smoke pots were about this high, and the stack going up was about like that.
It was about 4 feet high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. and the big bowl here that had black oil in it,
mm-hmm.
and when they lit them, of course, what that would do, they would put a layer of smoke, mm-hmm. black smoke, over the town, mm-hmm. and also over the canal, and in the canal they had lines of every 100 feet or 500 feet, I don't know, but of these, it was like a blimp, but it's a big balloon. You've seen them, if you've seen any World War II movies mm-hmm. in England, they would have these blimps or balloons up there that were shaped. Well, they were smaller than than your Goodyear blimp. They were about one third the size of okay. or one quarter the size. Mm-hmm. But they had those on cables floating up above the canal, right down the strip of the canal. That was for airplanes taken. In those days, you had propeller airplanes, and they mm-hmm. could go real low and all. And then we got right in our backyard was a gun emplacement, anti-aircraft gun emplacement. The soldiers would mm-hmm. come. And of course, we'd intermingle with them, and of course, sometimes on the lawn, we'd make a big dish of roast con pollo or spaghetti and all, and take it down to their tents, and they were by their tents and all. Mm-hmm. But they had those strategically placed around the town, and then they built, every town had bomb shelters to go to, and they built two or three bomb shelters that were a small room, I would say, about the square, about the same size as that darkest part of the wall,
mm-hmm.
and we would then, and the walls were about a good 2 feet thick of cement, and that would be our bomb shelters if they came. But and then on the breakwater that entering the canal on the Atlantic side, of course, they had a lot of German subs that were out there, and so they would, in the breakwater would be a bunch of blocks or whatever, closing the bay, so that they had to come through. The ships could only pass through this, and in that area there, they had submarine nets, the big nets, wired nets with their diameter would be about 1 foot in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
To catch the subs and what have you that would enter in.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, when I got out of school, the first job I had with the military was Net Depot, where they made the nets and all.
And these nets were metallic, made out of wire?
Yeah, they were made out of, mm-hmm. well, the wire was about twice the size of this.
And cord, okay.
Yeah, and it was woven mm-hmm. Up into, and it was woven up to about maybe 3/4 of an inch in diameter mm-hmm. all the way around. And they would intertwine those with, like that.
Did you guys ever catch a submarine?
They never came in that close because they also had, on the Atlantic side, we had Coca-Solo.
Mm-hmm.
And Coca-Solo was a submarine base,
mm-hmm.
in addition to a seaplane base. So your seaplanes were PBMs and PBYs, they were big, they were the hurricane hunters.
Yeah.
They would go out and fly around the
check
area
around.
To check on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that we didn't have any, we had about two or three scares. But throughout the canal, they had these big smoke pots and all. And
were those lit often or no?
No, they only had to light them about. We only had, I would say no more than, can't remember any more than four times.
Mm-hmm.
But they were all alert, and of course they put up air raid sirens in every town and all. Mm-hmm.
Got ready. What year did you say that you left the zone? Just so I
left in 82.
1982. Okay, so you were there for the 64 riots, 59 and 64.
You bet.
Yeah.
I was on the Atlantic side.
On the Atlantic side. So.
Could look out my. I was a technician in the telephone exchange at that time,
mm-hmm.
and we were. No more than 250 feet away from the border.
Oh my goodness!
They killed, the first one that was killed was right outside of our building, first American soldier that was hit.
Was that in 59, the first?
No, well, the 59, it was a different one. This was a 64. The 59 one was just rioting, but no shooting or anything like that. And we were, at that time, we lived in, let's see, it was 59. We still lived in New Cristobal. New Cristobal was turned over to Panama in 59. Mm-hmm. That was our high school, the whole town, the hospital. And that was turned over. So we, but at the same time, the Navy had abandoned Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. So we were moved to the officers' quarters, and all were refurbished, and we were moved out of New Cristobal to Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. And that's another story.
How did people feel about New Cristobal being turned over in 1959? Zonians, the Americans, did they was there resentment about that kind of building?
They basically didn't. Those of us that were living there did not like it. Did not like what they did to us. We were, well, we had a by that time I had a cottage right across from the high school, a big cottage right across from the high school with a big avocado tree that gave you the best pears in the world. And I had, let's see, June was about, she was about 3 years old. And, you know, June was, yeah, she was five. She was older than that. She was five. Mm-hmm. And, but it was a nice town. It, we got along fine with Panamanians. Most of our close friends were on the Panamanian side.
Okay.
My closest friend, who was like a brother, almost better. Closer than my brothers, and I was the middle one, so and they didn't know I was there. Mm-hmm. And was a Swiss. His parents owned a jewelry store, and they were Swiss. And Chuck and I, Chuck Perrette and I, the Swiss, started our friendship when I was in junior high school, and then when he graduated, and of course he went to school, and they sent him to Switzerland to go to school, to watch school, and all, and he came back, married. His wife was from Lausanne, and she couldn't speak anything but French, and so my wife took her under her arm, and in 3 months she was speaking French. I mean, she was speaking French all the time. She was speaking English fluently and Spanish fluently.
Wow.
It was amazing.
Yeah, but the way people picked that up.
They were like sisters, the two of them. They were, they were very close, and but the I was in an elevator in this hotel, and halfway up, and I was in there an hour and 45 minutes about.
Gosh, because they lost power.
Close to it, yeah, they lost power.
In this hotel. When was that?
And it was the one. Oh, this was. Let's see, when we started. It was back in the late 80s, I guess, early 90s. We first moved out, and it was one of those that were an express one. It went only so many floors, and then
you had to. Mm-hmm.
And there was no way to get out.
Scary.
No escape. But anyway.
Yeah. So 1964, the big riot. You know, and that kind of changes.
Yeah,
when you say it, kind of changes the whole atmosphere.
In 59, the two of us, my wife and I, were the first ones. In Colon, they were, during that time, they were stopping people, U.S. people, from going into Colon itself.
Mm-hmm.
Except for us, the two of us. They were told by the police and the fire department to leave us alone. And we would go down the main street to 11th Street, and that's where the fire station was and the police station and all. But they gave us safe passage to visit our friends and all. And after the first week after that, Panamanians, I guess they called it the 20-30 Club. You had to be in that age group. And that was a Panamanian club. And they were having a convention in David, way up in the interior. And they decided they wanted, I had enough of my personal friends, Marge's personal friends that belonged to the club, and they wanted us to go up there with them. And so we were the first Americans back after 59 into the towns.
And they were receptive to you.
Oh,
yeah.
Geez. Of course, back in those days, you could, this gringo now, and a gringa, and then they'd refer to my wife as a gringa. Hey, gringa, you want us to squirt? And their favorite drink was squirting their special alcohol beverage. I can't think of the name of it now. It'll come to me tomorrow.
All right.
But in the 64 riots, the first soldier was killed. They lined the soldiers up about 100 feet from us, shoulder length away, without any guns, mm-hmm. without any bullets. And the first one was shot, and then it was changed. And I would have to drive at night to get by town, because we lived in Coca-Cola then,
mm-hmm.
and to get in order to get to work and all. And it was the sharpshooters for the military were in our building, we would when they were getting ready to they had the gas stations were across the street, Colon gas stations, and the pickup would come, fill up with gas and go, and then come back again, fill up with gas. And that was for making the Molotov cocktails. And so they put an end to that real quick. They started to do some of their own shooting. But they never used the real bullets. They used the grenades with a gun. And they'd shoot the. It was a. One of the grenades would go in, bounce, and go into the driver's seat of the pickup. And that's how they would.
Oh my gosh, it's nerve-wracking.
Yeah, and that turned the 64 riots. I always would tell everybody that when I retire, I'll be the last person standing and waving goodbye to you all on the docks. But that sort of turned me off.
Mm-hmm. Why did you eventually leave the canal zone?
I retired I had 35 years of service.
Mm-hmm.
I was head of the telephone systems for the canal, the whole canal, and I was part of the treaty implementation on the communication side, and I had to do a lot of negotiating. Not only that, I had promised them that I would see to it that the whole canal had electronic telephone systems. Mm-hmm. So all the towns and on the locks, and I told them, and when I finish that project, I'm retiring. I'm getting out of here. And the negotiations were hard to take, simply because the military wanted to give the kitchen sink away, and the State Department went along with them, would try to go along with them, and of course I would try to stay to the written portion of it, and it was always an argument with them. I don't have high regards for the State Department. I saw too many secret portions of the treaty that turned my stomach over, and the assistant, the head negotiator for the canal, was in his 80s. And now I'm saying that because I'm 80. he was in his 80s, and he would doze off in the negotiations. Mm-hmm. So they had. Carter couldn't get Linowitz to be approved with Congress, so he waited until Congress was in recess, and then he appointed Linowitz. So Linowitz had 6 months to be the assistant negotiator. Actually, he was a negotiator. Mm-hmm. And I can say this much, the one in the documents and all, the Linowitz was a director of the Marine Midland Bank. Panama owed the Marine Midland Bank $362 million. Mm-hmm. And that $362, and a clause in the treaty was that Panama would be paid $362 to pay off their debt with the Marine Midland Bank. So various things. They wanted to get rid of AT&T, so the cable between the United States and Panama, at those times, the satellite was still just coming in at that time. AT&T had owned the cable from Florida to Jamaica. Mm-hmm. And AT&T owned the cable from Jamaica to Panama. And the way they got rid of AT&T was AT&T would not pass any communications to Panama. Mm-hmm. So AT&T couldn't, they were just a local outfit then, and they couldn't compete with the Panamanian telecommunications. Mm-hmm. So AT&T went out of business. Yeah. But anyway.
So by 1982, you were ready to get out of there.
Yeah, in 82, yeah. I gave them a day and a half notice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well.
But I did give them a check. I told them. And by that time, they wanted any promotions to be Panamanian, and mm-hmm. I refused. And so I was arguing with my directors, but I told them I would stay on the job for 6 months after I retired, provided they let me promote my own mm-hmm. man. And they said, okay, we'll let you, whoever you pick, we'll make them the chief of the telephone systems. And
that's not a bad deal. Where'd you relocate to in
States? My mom lived in St. Pete. Mm-hmm. They retired and went to St. Pete, and many of their friends were in that area, so they settled there.
Mm-hmm.
And so my dad had died, and my mom was getting up in age, and I felt that she needed
The support.
Support.
Was it difficult for you, your wife, to do that, you know, to relocate and move out of the zone?
Because we had so many close friends that it mm-hmm. was, she moved away from, we moved away from the one person that was more of sister than her sisters were at that time.
Yeah.
Later on, now the her sister she had one, two, three sisters. The one in the middle, right after the one that was about 2 years younger, and my wife got together and. Real close, and they were real close. And
that's good.
But no, it was a struggle to do that for them. I don't go north anymore.
No reason to. It's cold up there.
Well, we used to. They wanted us. They wanted the Americans to take at least every 2 years to get out of the tropics.
Mm-hmm.
And I practice that. In fact. The first time I ever went to the United States
mm-hmm.
was with my wife. I had never, mm-hmm. of course, my dad, mom, and dad, they up until the latter part of their working life,
mm-hmm.
they didn't have the money, and then after that, they were saving to retire, and so I went to the States for the first time after I was married,
mm-hmm.
and of course she was from Ohio. So, but I made it a point every 2 years we have our vacation. I would save my leave so that I have at least 6 weeks vacation, and we would go up visit friends in Pittsburgh Ohio, and my brother lived in Michigan. But the other thing, and of course, and go down to my mom in Florida. But I made it a point with my kids to every time we went up, came up, we went to another state. So mm-hmm. they are well versed in the
nice.
United States.
Yeah.
And I didn't have it, but I made sure that they had it. Of course, mm-hmm. And the other thing about that we had that our friends were more on the Panamanian side. That doesn't mean they were Panamanian. That means that maybe their mother or father were from Europe.
Right.
We had a lot of European, mm-hmm. a lot of.
They're not U.S. citizens.
They're not U.S. citizens. They
yeah.
were business people, and we had some of them. Were Americans married to Panamanians, but we had the culture to give the kids. When I started with the Swiss people, I remember so I was astounded. They had me for lunch the first time they had me for lunch over at their house, and. Of course, the natural thing is to pick up a sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a nice sandwich there, and I picked it up to eat. And they looked at me and said, "Pete, don't you use your fork mm-hmm. and knife?" And I said, "Yeah, but I got a sandwich here." He said, "No, you're supposed to eat with knife and fork.
It's very interesting.
And various, there was a tremendous, in the culture, and in the food.
Differences, yeah.
The difference was so big. And in those days, Swiss colony wines were the only wines that were exported out of the United States, and they were dessert wine. And our American friends would drink this dessert wine while I'm drinking French wine, and the best. And then they'd bring over every, since they were, also the father was a consulate, so he got to, once or twice a year, they would ship some Swiss wine over, and they'd always give us a case of it. But we got to our girls got a chance to have a different culture, and they.
That's a good experience.
And on top of that, they knew how to drink when they were away from us.
Mm-hmm.
They.
That responsibility.
The response. Yeah. They knew that.
The maturity. Yeah.
Well, you know, so many of the kids drink to get drunk, and we drink to enjoy the taste. Mm-hmm. It might take me for a little glass of Manhattan. Might take me a half an hour before I can finish that little glass, because, and our kids were in the with the wine and all. Our kids were taught to. If you don't like the taste, don't drink it, and only drink so much, and enjoy. If you can enjoy the taste, then stay away from it. And and that's
good lesson.
That's and then we would the way my mom and dad started was they would go to lunch at the and of course we're going back to the 30s, and we would go to the lounge or bar, whatever you want to call it, and then if they had a child with them and they ordered beer with their meal, the child always got what they called a pony. A little, about 2 ounces at the most. But the child always got, they always brought a pony for the child. And so, heck, from the time I was, what, 6 years old, I was tasting beer. But I don't like beer that I, up until about 20 years ago, I started drinking, well, I started actually drinking beer when I was a coppersmith apprentice.
Okay. I don't want to rush, but I know that they're going to need to use this room in a couple of minutes. Let me check the time.
Okay.
I know there's a new there's an interview at 4.
Very good.
So maybe just as a kind of closing thought, you could tell me about how, you know, your thoughts and feelings and opinion about the U.S. turnover of the Canal Zone and, you know, how you think they're doing with it now.
All right. The turnover of the Canal Zone, I think, actually, I knew a lot of the Panamanian politicians. They started out as all they wanted was to, right at that time, they were getting, Panama was being paid $250,000 a year for the use of, and that that changed. All Panama wanted was, because in Spain, U.S. was paying $20 million a year, and they wanted to be equal to. And instead, they gave them the canal and paid them to take it.
Just a few more minutes.
The Salandas. The U.S. I think did the U.S. wrong, and I was because I didn't think Panama would be able to handle it, but I've been down there a couple of times, and I'm very pleased with their, very pleased with what they've done. They've done things that the U.S. wouldn't have done, and they're better off. They're better off.
Good. And,
but I didn't think highly of Carter. He had had us at an when he came down, he made sure that he would be stay in the military base. Mm-hmm. The military were commanded to be in civilian clothes, mm-hmm. and they wouldn't let any Pan-Canal people except the higher ups on the base in order to see Carter. So.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to hit stop on this.